Comic book does whatever a book does. Read by us while drinking, incoherent rambling. Look out, this is our podcast.
Welcome to the SJW Comic Book Club, a weekly book club style podcast where three friends discuss a story arc or event in comics. Like most successful book clubs, we have three key elements: books, friends, and booze. I'm host number one, Monte.
I'm host number two, Veronica.
And I'm host number three, Melissa.
The three of us have been friends for years, ever since middle school, and we've always been really into books, movies, and other types of media. We've also always talked to each other quite a bit about what we're watching or reading, because the best part of consuming media is talking about it with your friends. So that's what we do with this podcast. We take an arc in comics, and we discuss it from a literary and progressive point of view. And before we start with today's episode, as with previous episodes, we are going to be talking about an LGBT super couple in this episode, and our couple is made up of the characters Carolina and Zavin. So my question to you guys is, whom do you prefer, Carolina or Zavin?
I think that I would prefer it's Carolina, right?
I don't really know.
I think it's Carolina. I think we... How about this? We had an episode where we read the first ever Runaways comic and we called her Carolina the entire time. So let's, for this one, do Carolina, and then we'll be covered.
Base is covered.
Yeah. Base is covered.
No one can say that we were always wrong.
Exactly. All right. So Carolina, I'm going to pick Carolina because she seems like someone who looks really pretty all the time. And glows in the dark, so you never have to, like, turn on that stupid flashlight app on your phone to find something. And she seems like a cool person to hang around. Maybe go to the mall. I don't know. Watch a movie. She definitely seems very chill. And doesn't currently have a identity crisis at the moment on this comic.
It's true. She seems pretty secure in her identity. She is also very pretty when she is glowing like a rainbow smoke monster, which is very distracting from the main point, unless all you care about is looks. But if you're looking for personality, hard to see past the glowy rainbow smoke. But I think I would go with Zavin. They are experiencing an identity crisis, but I also like, you know, questioning gender norms. I always try to question gender roles and stereotypes and assumptions, and I like other people who do that as well, so I feel like I could get along with Zavin.
Zavin might not be great on a school project where you're on a team and everyone needs to work together because he kind of wants to be in charge, but
that's true.
Just in that instance. That's why I didn't pick him.
But if your group project was to put on some kind of skit or play, you could have a lot more characters and easier costume changes if Zavin was on your team.
It's very true.
So I would also, I think, pick Zavin. While Carolina is very cool, I think Zavin's a bit cooler. And I think Zavin would just be the type to, like, they're in control of things, and so I wouldn't have to do stuff, you know? I wouldn't have to do anything. I wouldn't have to really make any decisions. Let's go to a movie. There's no, like, back and forth about, oh, what do you want to see? What do you want to see? Zavin's just like, I want to see this. And I'd just be like, all right.
All right. And on the other hand, they are very, like, dedicated to their partner. And if you did have something you wanted to see, they would probably just go along with what you wanted.
So each season, Veronica and I pick a theme.
My theme this season is green. All the comic star green characters.
And my theme this season, as I hinted at before, is LGBT super couples. And in keeping with that theme, this week we read Runaways, Volume 2, published in 2006, issues number 19 through 24. And this is written by Brian K. Vaughan of Saga fame, and drawn by Mike Norton in the first three issues and Adrian Alfona in the second three issues. This story was written by award-winning author Brian K. Vaughan, who would later write the series Saga, which we read and talked about, actually, in episode 15 of our previous show, The Bottle Comic. The story was released in 2006, so it was significantly earlier than Saga, which came out in 2012, but it definitely isn't the beginning of Vaughan's writing career. By 2006, Vaughan had already written several award-winning series, such as Ex Machina and Why the Last Man. He had also been writing for major studios such as Marvel, DC, and Wildstorm since the 90s. He wrote on like Batman, Superman, and a few X-Men stories as well. And then actually, he also did some writing on Swamp Thing.
He did.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't Marvel or DC at the time, but what was it? Vertigo,
it was Vertigo
or Image?
Yeah. Which is a DC imprint, but yeah.
So he was a pretty prolific writer at this point in his career. This story in particular takes place during Civil War, which is a fight between Marvel's superheroes regarding registration. The Runaways have mostly stayed out of the fighting, however, the changes regarding registration and the threat of being arrested by Tony Stark's Cape Killers, which we see at the end of issue 24, have impacted them somewhat and has caused some anxiety, I guess you would say, among the team. The Runaways have also suffered several severe losses, such as the death of teammate Gertrude Yorks, the betrayal of teammate Alex Wilder, who we saw when we read the the first issues of Runaways.
So it was Alex.
Yeah, Alex was a mole within them who was actually working with their parents. And then also the deaths of their parents. So they've suffered quite a bit of loss. Like, their parents were evil or whatever, but they were still their parents. So, you know, watching them die horribly was probably a pretty traumatic event. At this point, the Runaways are trying to protect LA and clean up the messes their parents left behind while also surviving in a post-registration world. The central conflict of issues 19 through 24 is the loss of Gertrude Yorks and the integration of new team member Zavin into the Runaways. While Zavin seems to be happy in their relationship with Carolina, they are having trouble adjusting to the other Runaways and vice versa. So there's a lot of tension within the team because of this new person that, as Molly so eloquently says during the reading, makes everyone uncomfortable. The team is called on to fight a massive monster destroying all the new buildings in LA, who is revealed to be an old man trying to recreate the past. Then they are faced with a young man trying to recreate the past when former team member Chase Stein, who was Gertrude's boyfriend, makes a deal with the Jaborim, who are the elder gods who their parents served and who gave their parents power, in order to bring Gertrude back to life. If Chase brings the Jaborim an innocent soul as a sacrifice, the Jaborim will resurrect Gertrude. If he doesn't provide the Jaborim with a sacrifice, they will phase out of existence, and with them will go any chance of bringing Gertrude back to life. So that is what we read this week. And Melissa, what are we drinking this week?
This week we are drinking something we've actually had before. Don't ask me on what episode, but it was a long time ago, so I think it's fair to drink. It's like you buy a dress and you can wear it more than once kind of thing.
Yeah. You can never wear a dress more than once.
Yeah. Anyway, it's called, I think we called it Melissa's Sunrise, the prize or something. I don't know. Back in college, I made a drink with sherbet, Sprite, and like different flavored vodkas and liqueurs and stuff. And it was just a really sugary, powerful drink. And because I really liked how when you pour Sprite over a sherbet, it makes that foam. Anyway, you don't have to make a giant punch bowl of it. You can make it in your own home in a cup.
And then you get a delightful rainbow colored drink.
You don't even have to add alcohol. You can just have a drink from your childhood in about 1,000 calories. Sherbet, yes. Sprite in a cup.
Sherbet float situation. Yep. Delicious.
Yes, fantastic. So before we get into the discussion points for this week, what are you guys' general impressions of this story?
I thought it was pretty interesting. I went on and read some more of Saga by Brian K. Vaughan, and I can definitely see the comparisons of like a lot of more difficult emotional situations are being gotten into than are just inherently present in the premise that we started with back when we read the first few issues. And that even had a lot of promise with like the parents being villains, the whole idea. Like, that's rife with emotional stuff. But you can see that they've continued to introduce all these interesting, nuanced, gray area emotional issues for the characters to deal with, and a lot of hardship and a lot of darkness, but without being 100% depressing. Like, this was about the death of their friend who is a kid like them, and it was definitely somber, but it wasn't like bleak all the time. So I enjoyed reading it a lot. I enjoyed meeting a couple new characters and thinking about the consequences of the relationships that are being shown.
Yeah, I think the story does a pretty good job of depicting grief and how individual people might deal with it. I liked this story basically as much as I liked the first ever Runaways comic that we read. It was like the first issue of the first volume. And this is, what, the second volume?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So lots has happened since that first comic. And so it's kind of interesting to see how they've progressed and moved on. I really liked it. I really like how interesting the relationship between Zavin and Carolina is. And Chase, what the fuck, bruh? Like, what's going on, Chase? What's going on?
Yeah.
Figure your shit out. What is this? Oh, Chase.
Our poor, misguided baby.
Yeah, I think I also felt very similar to how I felt about the first arc. It's pretty similar to where I could take or leave this story. Like, I didn't dislike it, but I also didn't particularly like it. It was just like, it was all right, you know? It was a decent story, I thought. I did think that it handled the themes very well, and I liked how the theme of grief and sort of moving on from the past was just really baked into pretty much every single story arc and every single character, and pretty much everything that happened. So, like, kudos for that. Like, I think it was well written and stuff, but it's just there was something that didn't really do it for me. So it was just like, I wouldn't revisit it, is what I'm saying.
One thing I really appreciated was that Gertrude did not come back. Gert was not resurrected. They obviously sort of dangle it over you multiple times as a possibility of maybe it's going to happen now. And I feel like with comics, so often, no one's ever dead forever. And, or even on, you know, television, movie, or maybe not movies, but you know what I mean? Television and comics. This person dies, but they're probably going to come back. And I was worried that she was going to come back so quickly after dying, which would sort of negate that powerful grief theme throughout this whole thing. But they didn't bring her back, which I really liked. I kind of was reading the letters to the editor at the end, and Brian K. Vaughan seemed really adamant that Gertrude was going to stay dead. But I've heard, I think we were talking before this, that she does in fact come back through different writers.
So. It's quite a ways in the future, though.
Yeah, it's many, many years later. Recent story.
Yeah, it might be more than 10 years later in the real world that...
Okay. It's 2017, so yeah.
Yeah. So
a whole decade.
Yes, at least for the impact of this story and the direction it was going at the time, she's permanently dead as far as... all the storylines are concerned. Which, yeah, Brian K. Vaughan, I think, does a really good job of presenting difficult situations and not the best decisions by his characters without judging them necessarily and without preaching about what the right way to do things is and just sort of giving you characters rolling with the things that happen to them.
So as far as the plot and like the different things that happened, I feel like this story was a lot more character driven than it was plot driven. A lot of the different twists and turns of the story didn't really matter as much as the psychology and like the behavior of the different characters. But what did you guys think overall of the plot? Like, what stuck out to you?
As you said, like, some of the things I forgot about until we went through the second time, like the actual plot of the monster in the first arc that was destroying new things, like, that was there. But when I went back, I was like, oh yeah, the reason this happened was one of the cops who investigated the death of their parents or whatever stole an artifact that belonged to Nico's parents and was trying to pawn it to this guy who just happened to be holding it when he wished things would go back to the way they were. And so he became a giant monster. And, like, I hadn't remembered that until I went back because I was so focused on what the characters were doing and the grief they were going through and the relationships they were negotiating. But even that is pretty on point because as a team of superheroes, like, you can always have superhero, like, interrelations, but you also have to have the plot of, like, what are they doing that makes them superheroes? What crimes are they solving? And this group is cleaning up their parents' messes, and that's definitely what that is. Artifacts left behind by their parents causing untold levels of property damage and probably some death. Like, it's not said. Someone died in that monster rampage.
Yeah, I would think a lot of people died because there were a lot of skyscrapers with pretty significant damage.
And there was no offhand joke about, ha ha, all the empty skyscrapers like we had in the Martian Manhunter issue with Plastic Man. So it seems like some really significant dangerous stuff was happening.
The whole plot of grumpy old man is mad that the world has changed. Old man yells into the, what is it, the Simpson meme? Old man yells at the sky or something.
Yeah.
People are changing and they're doing something different, or children are still hooligans, but it's worse when they do it now. Whatever. And then he has the opportunity to fix everything, and what does he do? He just murders a bunch of people and destroys Starbucks. So,
right,
very deep.
which then it turns out that his old mannishness is tied to grief for his wife and his youth, which are tied together because she died, it seems like, when they were pretty young. So then it loops back into itself. But
yeah, I would say, though, what he does with his giant monster powers doesn't solve any of the problems that he was complaining about. Because
no, it's just
destroying
emotional
buildings doesn't stop children from being disrespectful.
It's just emotional lashing out at the world changing.
Yeah, which is why I think it was such a good parallel with Chase. Like, what the old man was trying to do, what he wanted to do, was to have things go back to the way they were back when he was happy. And so then his way to achieve that, well, I mean, he didn't wish for violence. It was like a warp of his wish. But like the way that he goes about achieving that is a violent way that's not actually going to do any, like, progress isn't going to stop because you smash a bunch of Starbucks. They're just going to rebuild them. and in the same way, like Chase bringing back, if he did, like, let's say that Chase was successful, and let's say that he did successfully sacrifice someone and brought Gertrude back, like, she would not be happy about that. And, like, the trauma that that would inflict on her would make her a different person. Like, you wouldn't be able to turn back time and be happy. Like, the thing that you did would still, it would still have a hugely negative impact on you and everyone around you. And you're not going to be happy living in the past. Like, it's not possible. You can't do it.
And even when you realize that the solution he came to is that he should sacrifice himself, that when you get to that point, like there's various ways to take that conversation. Like, is that selfless to save somebody, or is that just a form of self-destruction due to your own grief? Like, you won't be in that world to meet Gertrude again. So
yeah, and like imagine what that will do to her.
Right, to realize that you decided it's essentially came down to you decided that you were worthless and she was more important than you. And that would hurt all your friends just as much. It would just be you wouldn't have to live in a world where Gertrude was dead, which is, you know, that's a sad emotional place to be where you think that that is the best thing and the best outcome that you could achieve. And he is, though 18, still a kid. And it's hard to think about. These guys are all kids and they're living under the La Brea tar pits. The tar pits, as the security guard points out. La Brea apparently means the tar. And they don't have any therapists. They don't have any parents. They just have each other to deal with all this trauma. And it's not going to be enough sometimes.
It most certainly is not.
No. especially since all the other people you have around you are also highly traumatized.
I like that they even mentioned that they can't go to therapy. They should go to therapy, but they can't because they are hiding out and it will yes. alert everyone.
Do you think, because Iron Man shows up at the end of the last one, because they left the La Brea Tar Pits without cloaking themselves in invisibility, and they got caught, apparently. Do you think that he's going to get them the therapy that they need?
My assumption is no.
Yeah, like, I'm tempted to read ahead a little bit just to see what this interaction is like, because after Melissa told us that she was reading the letters to the editor, I peeked at them on my go-through just now, and I saw this is the end of Brian K. Vaughan's writing The Runaways, it seems like. Like, he's moving on to other projects after this volume or collection or whatever. So I'm interested to see, like, are they going to be, like, super involved with Iron Man and Civil War, and how is that going to shake out, and is it going to stay in the story? Right.
I know I doubt, that doesn't happen.
Right. I doubt, because Runaways very much feels like it's not... It is in the continuity, but it's got its own story to tell and its own storyline to follow. So I'd be interested to see how that shakes out if I doubt Iron Man's going to take into account, oh, these are teenagers. I should probably care for them instead of police them to the degree I'm policing everybody else.
Nope. Iron Man does not appear in... Oh, wait.
I assume they at least have to resolve having been caught, but apart from that.
No, he doesn't even appear in the next issue. In what? Volume 25, Iron Man is not in it.
What?
There is a flashback with some of the other Avengers in it, so they might resolve it quickly through a flashback, and the team ends up in New York City somehow. I'm assuming through Iron Man's actions, but nope, he doesn't appear for the rest of the volume.
I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say maybe something happens in a different comic surrounding Civil War with them in it.
I did not fail to notice that Iron Man showed up pretty quickly to bust in on some teenagers' hideout, but when a giant monster is destroying all of LA, just taking my sweet old time.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
So helpful. Thank you.
Just like a cop.
They had a couple of quips against cops shooting at unarmed teenagers, and
that same detective who caused all these problems shot at them. That was shade. That was a shady thing to do. Ex-cop. Yes. He's not even a cop anymore. What a jerk.
Moving on to the Runaways as a team, what did you guys think of them, like, as different characters, the characters that aren't Carolina and Zavin? What did you guys think of them?
I think Nico and Molly are still my favorites. I don't remember if they were my favorites. I think maybe Carolina was one of my favorites from when we first read about them. But I think Molly and Nico are my secondary favorites, because Molly is still learning, still being cute, and honestly saying things that need to be said. Mm-hmm. She is helping this group of kids develop. Emotionally, because she's just getting stuff out there in the open that should just be said.
Yeah, it's pretty refreshing to not stew in that stuff, which once again, Brian K. Vaughan is good at. He presents these complex emotional issues and doesn't let them stew for all eternity. Like, we're dealing with it. But yeah, I liked all the characters that we already know seemed consistent and going through. The story really feels a lot more mature than it felt when we read the first issues. Not least of all because of the way it was packaged in, I think the issues we read before came out in 2001, and this is 2006, you said?
Yeah.
So, I don't know if, like, the target demographic has adjusted a little bit, but even, like, looking at the covers, they were very cartoony before, and they're pretty unique right now, but feel a little bit more mature. Not like to an adult level, but to a less cartoony and a more thoughtful level, where characters are really like digging in and showing all these emotions that were just on the surface before. Yeah. And I did enjoy the new characters as well. Like, Zavin seems interesting. Like, I didn't read what happened to have Zavin end up on this team, but you gave us a little bit of background on it, and that's really interesting. I'd never even heard of, what's his name?
Victor Mancha.
Yeah, Son of Ultron, I believe he's been called. So he's apparently like an android or a cyborg or something. But he seems interesting as well. And I think that even as Molly says, it's uncomfortable when a new person joins. And until a newer person joins, it remains uncomfortable. I think they fit really well with the team as like kids who are separated from any kind of support system and trying to be heroes.
I think that also is a function of, you know, when we first read The Runaways, it was a brand new team, like a brand new story, a brand new concept. So it can take a while to kind of develop that into something that's a little bit more mature. And a lot of times I think the creators of teams and characters, even though they are, you know, they set the foundation for sure, but a lot of times I feel like the people who actually make the characters interesting or make the team, you know, more interesting and actually see the potential isn't necessarily the original creators. It's usually the like second or third writers, at least with comics. Like it's that way with X-Men, as we talked about with Richter and Shatterstar. Shatterstar, I know a lot of people love the original Shatterstar. I know. He is incredibly boring and he is barely a character at all. And it takes like eventually someone to come in and see the potential of that character and sort of revitalize them to make them more interesting. And I think that that definitely happens with Runaways because like as each writer takes over, they are building on what previous writers have done, and they, I think, understand a little bit more than past writers can how audiences are going to interact with those characters.
Yes, I think this is a pretty present function of like creativity and world building. I've been watching a lot of videos about making your writing marketable to publishers and agents. A lot of the advice I already knew, but it brought it back to my mind of like, there's a lot of temptation when you're creating a story, especially an ongoing story with an ongoing world, to do a lot of world building, or in a less stagnant sense, a lot of like team building and foundation premise building, without thinking about like how it needs to change to make a compelling story as you go forward. Whereas a writer who is coming onto the series and has read just the premise that you've given them, or your readers themselves, they see like, oh, this is intriguing because of where it's going to go, rather than what you've established at the beginning, which can be fun. That's where you launch off from, rather than I've already done all the work and here it is. Here's where we're going.
Any other points about the team?
Chase is having emotions.
He is.
And he is technically dealing with those emotions. No one can say he's not doing nothing. He is, in fact, trying very hard. Perhaps.
To do something.
To just do something. He explores multiple avenues to handle his grief, and all of them not great.
But despite his self-destructiveness, which is very bad emotionally, a very bad emotional place to go to, I was very relieved that he didn't go to the other place of what they were teasing all along, which was that he was going to sacrifice somebody else. It seems like he really never had that intention. He was tempted to do it and then realized, oh, I can't do that. So I was happy that, because stuff can go so dark and people are like, haha, that's intriguing, that's interesting. And I'm like, but you don't need to make every character go to that place where they become a bad person to have an intriguing emotional journey.
Yeah, I think flirting with that kind of desire and need to do something, and even if it feel like you know it's destructive, but you don't care, and it's okay that he's flirting with it, but the fact that he doesn't go through with it is good.
Right.
He will be able to heal, hopefully, moving forward. He has broken the trust of a couple of individuals in his group, so here's hoping he can build that trust again. But yeah, he just needs a hug and some therapy. Just like, what was it, Nico and Victor were talking about it?
Mm-hmm.
Boy needs some therapy.
Yes. So many characters need some therapy.
Yes. I did appreciate that. I think it was Nico that said it, but who said, like, he needs to go to... Oh, no, it was Victor. It was Victor who said he needs to go to therapy. And then Nico was like, no, the therapist will just call the cops, which, no. They won't.
That's not how it works.
Nico, that's the point.
Yes, unless you're endangering children. Other children, not yourself.
Or yourself. Yeah, if you...
In certain ways.
Yeah.
Right, but not to the cops.
No, to the cops. To the president himself.
Not to
the
Iron
FBI.
Man. There's no mandatory reporters to Iron Man.
As soon as you say the words, SWAT just busts into the office.
To save your life.
Yeah. Opens fire. All right, so to the main characters, they weren't really... Well, this one, I appreciated this more than X Factor, because in this one, the relationship between Zavin and Carolina was actually front and center and was a big part of the actual plot and like related to the central conflict, which was cool.
Yeah.
So what did you guys think of them as a couple and as individual characters?
They seem a lot like Richter and Shatterstar. Like they're still kind of in the negotiating phase of this relationship. Like I haven't read what came before. It seems like they've definitely decided that they're together and they're an item, as it were. But it still seems like they're not clear yet on, like, what that relationship is going to look like or how they're going to, like, settle into domesticity and routine in it.
Really?
And that's an interesting place to be. I think they're a little more established than Richter and Shatterstar because, I mean, they live together and it hasn't been literally, like, a couple hours since they decided to be together.
Do you think that some of that might be coming from Zavin not really knowing what their place is on Earth, period?
Yes.
Like, it seemed to me like they knew where they stood in relation to each other and that they had a good idea of their relationship with each other, but that Zavin just wasn't sure how they fit on Earth, period.
I think it's part that and also part the fact that they are equivalent to being teenagers. I don't know how old Zavin is in year... length, but like this is a story focused
in scroll years
like they're definitely youths, so it's definitely a youthful relationship that they're having, and just like all these kids I'd be seeing in high school, like it's an established thing, but it's not a thing that can move forward as quickly as an adult relationship can. Like they already live together, obviously, and they're superheroes and they're on the run, so it doesn't have all the hallmarks that, or all the milestones that another normal relationship in the real world would have. But it's not a thing where they're like, okay, I'm planning, we're gonna get an apartment and then we're gonna live there for a few years and we're gonna get married and then you're gonna get this job or whatever and we're gonna get promoted. Like it's moving along at a pace where they don't feel pressured to, you know, make new steps in that way. So they're content to just be together in that way.
Zavin's arc is really interesting in this story, where it starts off with him realizing that he can't go back, he can't leave Earth, his ship is broken, and he won't be able to rejoin anyone of his race at this point. Also grieving millions of deaths. Mm-hmm. Which haven't been confirmed in this comic, but let's just take it at their word that a planet that had millions of Skrull lives on it has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is horrible. And as someone who used to be in charge of a lot of people, maybe a general in war, I don't know, he mentions war a lot and sending troops to get slaughtered and stuff. And he has lots of pretty valid opinions about how teenagers should not be fighting wars.
Yes.
But they often are. The young people are the ones that have the least stake in someone's war and are the ones usually sent out to die for it.
Right.
But so he is not sure how he fits in with the group, and he naturally wants to take charge of things. And I really appreciated how Carolina sort of gently told him, hey, it's not really your place to tell people what to do. Nico's the one in charge. And it doesn't really matter that, like, right now, for communication, and we're fighting this big baddie, it's better if we're not confusing who's in charge here. So, and he fucks up twice. He has to, gets carried away from the first battle from Carolina. She's, like, holding him, lying in the air.
In the, like, nicest princess carry of all time.
Yeah. Beautiful. And no one really gives him crap for it, which I also appreciate. And then there's like another instance where he says, oh, I gotta make up for the fact that I fucked up before and I'm kind of embarrassed about it. And he does, and he kind of screws up again. And he's just trying. He's trying. Chase is trying. Zavin is trying. They all be trying right now.
Yes. That is an interesting dynamic, because as far as everyone who is in the Runaways charter team knows, they were all being raised in, you know, private families in the modern day United States. And Zavin, I don't know if, how their childhood looked like, but they're raised as like royalty and, you know, in a military imperial society, and is used to, you know, fighting wars and stuff. And it's interesting. Also with Victor, I don't know how Victor was raised either, but Victor definitely seems to have a knowledge of his, like, anatomy and has fought and might have been a villain in the past even. But it's interesting to see their dynamic as they come into this group of people who've known each other most of their lives as just like, oh, those, that's just my family friend. And now suddenly they're a family together, having run away from their parents. And it's interesting that both Zavin and Victor, who are establishing relationships with people in this group, are from outside the group and are having to negotiate that family feeling also. Like, Victor wants to kick Chase out, essentially. And everyone else is like, no, Chase is our family. And then that comes in a bit with Molly telling Zavin that they make everyone uncomfortable as well. Like, we'll accept you eventually, but right now, you make us all uncomfortable negotiating this situation with you.
It was really cute at the end where Zavin is talking with Molly and he is recovering from the battle with the, what are they, what are they called? Gimlets.
The Jaborim.
Jaborim. Whatever. I didn't write it down. The Jaborim, I think that was the second battle where he kind of gets struck down and it, and he is, his body is changed in a couple different ways, and he thinks to himself, because he cares about Molly, you know, as soon as I get enough strength, I'm going to change into a form that makes you comfortable, which I thought was really sweet. And then, of course, Molly turns around and says, oh, no, like, I'm cool. I'm a kid. And you're my sister now. And I've accepted you. And the acceptance of a child might sound dumb, but is clearly meaningful and powerful in a lot of ways. Having this person who could reject you and will tell you if they reject you, accept you, and be almost the first person, I mean, other than Carolina, to accept you in this group.
Yes. Even if you don't like kids necessarily, unless you actively hate them, you probably know the satisfaction of being like, hehe, the child likes me. I have been chosen. Not that Molly's like 12 or something and seems a little immature for her age even, but when kids and animals like you, it's the most accepted you'll ever feel.
Yeah. I really appreciated the conversation between Molly and Zavin, specifically when, well, I'll say this. I appreciated the conversation between Molly and Zavin for the way that they were talking about acceptance and the way that Molly was saying, basically just like, hang in there and it'll happen eventually where you'll be like a part of the team, but it's not going to happen overnight. Because this is, you know, this is a family. And if you're integrating into a family, that's something that takes time.
Right.
But I do think, so the way that the conversation starts is Molly asking Zavin why sometimes they look like a boy and sometimes they look like a girl. And I think that there was a really great opportunity to make up for some of the casual transphobia that was just really peppered into the beginning of the story.
Looking through it again, most of it comes from Victor, but it is casually present.
Most of it comes from Victor and from Nico, but the thing is that no one corrects them, which is why I would say it's just a casual transphobia that's thrown in.
Yes.
It's something that happens quite a bit in story. Like, it wasn't, it's not so bad that it would be like violent or it would make you dislike the story, but especially given that this was the end of Brian K. Vaughan's writing for the series, I wish that he would have resolved that a little bit better.
Right.
Just to say, Zavin doesn't have to choose whether or not they want to be present as a male or a female, and that doesn't give people the right to like use slurs or demean them in any way.
Yes.
Or, I mean, they didn't like, and that's not to say that they have to be like, these are my preferred pronouns and blah, blah, blah. Because like with Zevin's identity, that wouldn't matter. Like that, right. That was kind of the whole point, was that it just doesn't matter to them. But I don't know. I would have liked to see the casual transphobia and the gender stuff dealt with a little bit better than it was. Because right. It was just kind of dropped in there and then never picked up again.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a sign of the times or whatever.
I think it probably was.
Quote unquote. But reading it today, there's like, in these issues, only like two or three moments that were quippy about it. That were like terms that you would not expect to hear someone just drop. And I've talked before about how comic books, it's mostly DC, but this one was a little bit this way as well, making up these nicknames on the spot for people to like call out the qualities of them, like maybe to update new readers on like what the thing is about them. Like most of these people in Runaways just appear to be normal people. So if you want new readers to know what their powers are, you have to make a stupid nickname for them and throw it out there. But even given that quality, yeah, it was really like startling to read. Gender Bender was one, and I don't even really feel comfortable saying, should I say, I really feel uncomfortable saying, I'm going to say it, she-male. I don't know when I learned that you can't say that, but it was really a startling moment while reading.
I think that it was pretty bad in that aspect, which surprised me because I keep reading about how Zevin is such great representation. And I think that Zevin themselves, like, they are great representation. Like, the character is, but then the way that the character is treated by the rest of the team, at least in these story arcs, was a little bit shitty.
The way that it's couched in the language of the story, which there's no abstract narration in these stories, so it's all what people are saying.
It would be different if someone, like, even Carolina didn't really come to their defense at any point and be like, Zavin's trying to figure stuff out and trying to understand their gender identity or something like that. You know, there was never a point where anybody defended them from that.
Right.
Which is what bothered me, I think.
I think that's another reason it didn't feel as established of a relationship. Because, like, when your partner has anything about themselves that's, like, marked and noteworthy, like, you know about it and you're ready to describe and give it context for other people if needed. Like allergies, or you know about their job, or you know about if they're from another place, you know how to present that to other people. It didn't seem like Carolina really knew how to represent Zevin to other people. Carolina.
And we don't know if Zevin necessarily did, because they wouldn't have to. But yeah, overall, I thought that they were a pretty good couple. I just thought that it was weird that it seemed like they had each other's back for the most part, but
yeah.
It seemed like Carolina didn't have Zavin's back as much.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes sense because they don't, like, stay together as a couple. And Zevin eventually gets written out. And Carolina ends up with somebody else, so.
That's what I was going to say. From this point, and I know it because I know things about the story, but part of the way that makes me feel like they're not that established could also be, like, they don't seem like they really have the work in yet to be a couple that's going to last. And, like, you can interpret that as them being new and so it's not established yet, or as them not being a great fit necessarily, or not having staying power. But they seem like a healthy couple, but don't necessarily have signs yet or ever that they're going to go the mile, as it were.
So how do you think this compares to other depictions of LGBT couples that we've read in X Factor and Midnighter and Apollo?
It feels really like run-of-the-mill, like, really realistic to what, if there were Skrull who were genderqueer and could transform between representations of their own alien race and human in both male and female version, like what that would play out as. Like, nothing super exciting happens about it. It's casual, normal, negotiable.
Yes. Nothing super exciting except for their near sacrifice to the Elder Gods.
Aside from that. Aside from the being couched in this superhero lifestyle. Which I guess Midnighter and Apollo had a bit. Like, they were very domestic while also being superheroes.
Yeah, and I know it's not this relationship wasn't, like, the point of this story arc, I would say that the number one plot driving factor is Chase and his problems. And then you kind of have the old man, and then you kind of have Carolina and Zavin doing stuff on, like, the amount of time that we spend on it at any rate. And so I kind of wish we had gotten more. I think I might even consider reading more into it just to get a better idea of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But the one scene that we see them in where Zavin comes to bed and Carolina, he's like shape-shifted as Nico.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a conversation about expectations and, you know, who, you know, they're figuring things out, and they just, like, they get so close to getting somewhere, but then we just move on to the next thing and we don't really get into it. Kind of like the conversation with Zavin and Molly at the Risk game night table, where she brings up the interesting, well, Carolina is a lesbian, and why don't you just stay a girl the whole time? Because that's what Carolina would like. Which, out of the mouth of children, is a question that can be
very, very telling about other people's premises and attitudes.
Exactly. So, but when it's coming from her, it kind of has this innocence of just, I don't know, and I'm just curious. So it doesn't come off as shitty like the comments made by Victor at various points.
Who asked you, Victor?
Yeah,
shut
no
up.
One asked you. I like how he's finally accepted by the group, and then he's like, yeah, I'm a shit on the new guy.
That's totally what he does. Oh my god. Yes.
Victor. Yeah, but I mean, we see them being affectionate with each other, and it's really sweet in some ways. Like, directly when Carolina specifically is touching Zavin or something like that, Zavin sort of transforms into a female version of himself, or sorry, of themselves. And that's kind of all, you know, it's just, it's an interesting dynamic.
All right. So now that we have discussed these story arcs, are there any last words before we wrap this up?
I think I got a little more insight into how Victor is a douchebag. I was thinking he was cute, but then I realized, oh wait, he was the one being a jerk about Zavin's gender the whole time. So there's that. And then I liked hearing you guys' different views on Zavin and Carolina's relationship.
I have nothing to say. And I'm just going to say it, okay? I'm just going to say it that I have nothing to say.
Yeah, I also don't really have anything to say.
I think with the way our conversation pushed my conception of it just a little bit to what you guys noticed, I do kind of want to go back and read, like, the origin of Zavin a little bit more, and maybe a little further on in this story. Although once I realized it wasn't Brian K. Vaughan anymore, it's like, maybe they don't handle it so good. Or at least don't pick up the threads that he laid down. So, but I do want to see when Zavin and Carolina meet.
All right. So I guess we can move on to talk about our favorite panels. My favorite panel was in issue number 22. And it was the first actual page of the story where it introduces, what were they called? The Silver Bullet Gang, who Molly calls the Cowboy Werewolves. I don't know what it is. It's just a panel where they're all standing there, looking as menacing as they could look, because they are absolutely ridiculous and silly looking. And there's nothing intimidating about them at all. And the way that everyone reacts to them is no one's intimidated by them, which is great. They're just a very silly collection of villains.
Yes, it was a very interesting first page because it seemed like a completely different art style. Like, obviously, these issues are drawn by a different person than the arc before, but it was a big jump in art style and very cartoony. There were a lot of really beautiful or interesting pages in these issues, and like none of them had anything to do with Carolina or Zavin that I first picked out. And normally that wouldn't be a problem for me, but for some reason I felt like I really wanted to find a panel that sort of was about their relationship, because that's what I was interested in while it was happening. There's a really beautiful panel of Carolina in at the beginning of issue 23, but that's just to do with her. So eventually I remembered in issue 20, towards the end, after they've fought the big monster, which is very silly looking sometimes, at some point Zavin got overwhelmed fighting the monster, and Carolina is still, she's got her glow and what appears to be, I guess, is her like super suit, because we see her in it multiple times, like this really pretty black and gold or black and silver ensemble. And then Carolina is just, after Molly throws the monster, is just carrying Zavin in their scroll form, appears to be a male scroll form, back in like the most delicate princess carry, and looks really nice. And that was the one time that I felt like, because I feel like they have this relationship that exists as like alien prince-princess situation, and then this of the earth, like teenagery sort of relationship, and that was sort of a bridge between the two. Like they were fighting together and they look very regal in this moment, and it sort of gave a hint towards a little more towards their relationship. Also, Carolina is always very pretty when she has her glow going, so it's very visually pleasing.
My favorite panel was almost going to be in issue 24, where Victor speaks in binary. We've come across other characters doing that. It actually says something though in binary. Ooh. If you plug what he says into a binary translator, just Google it, he says WTF.
That's awesome.
I thought was delightful, but it has been trumped. And actually Molly is in that issue, and I realized I really loved panels that Molly is in. In the very first issue that we read, issue 19, I believe.
Yes.
Molly is talking to the frog.
Yes.
Car frog.
The leapfrog.
Ship, leapfrog ship. And because Molly talks to a lot of people. She's alone a lot. She talks to a portrait of Gertrude. She talks to Zavin. She talks to the frog vehicle. And she asks it if Gertrude is in heaven. And the frog vehicle says, "My global positioning satellite is unable to provide you with the information." And she's just like upset and says, "Then what good are you, you stupid freaking jumping thing?" And then he kind of gives this side look, yes, and then re-looks at her and says, "Stand by, software has been updated. Affirmative, can now confirm that Miss Yorkie's coordinates are located in heaven." And I was like, aww, that's nice.
That was one on my list. I love the way the leapfrog makes these like shady little side looks with his little front light eyes.
Yeah, and the fact
so cute.
It is kind of sad that Molly is having to speak with a robot, essentially, to deal with the loss of her friend Gertrude, but it did not fail her. So
no.
That was really adorable.
It's a good friend.
It's a good friend. So I'm going to take all these favorite panels and I'm going to post them to our Instagram at the SJW Comics Cast. So check us out. Let us know what your favorite panels are. And with that, I take us into our self-care corner. That we encourage our listeners to also partake in. Something that you guys did this week that was good for your mental, physical, spiritual, emotional, physical well-being.
All those types of
self-care.
Well-being.
What was your self-care last week?
So I didn't do anything super particular, but I've sort of continued all the things I've discussed in the last several weeks, you know, trying to not doom scroll, getting up and doing the physical parts of my job while trying not to be stressed out by the parts of my job I can't control, and participating in my hobbies that are, especially when they're hobbies you do by yourself, are easy to let fall by the wayside. So you're like, what's the point? No one even knows I'm doing, I'm not accomplishing anything, but it's fun. It relieves your stress. It makes you feel accomplished. So I did some baking today.
Nice.
Yes.
So I downloaded a new game through Xbox Game Pass, Stellaris, for console, which I've wanted to play for a long time, but it looked very complicated and difficult to learn how to play, so I haven't. But earlier this week, I downloaded it, and I've been playing it, and it's pretty fun. It's not as complicated as it seemed at first, also. So
nice.
Nice. Mine is also related to yours, Monte, and that is a video game. I remember that I had Zoo Tycoon on my laptop, and I've been playing it for like an hour sometimes at night when I have the chance to. And I remember why I love Zoo Tycoon, which is very satisfying and fulfilling. I feel fulfilled emotionally.
It is one of the best games.
Zoo Tycoon 2, I will clarify, Zoo Tycoon 2.
You have to be very specific in your theme park sim building games, which version
it's,
is the
it's
best
It's literally
one.
The best one. So take my word for it.
Say Roller Coaster Tycoon 3, I believe, is the best one. Maybe it's 2. Yes, so make sure to take care of yourselves this week as well. Next week, I hope you will join us for a very exciting day in which we will be collaborating with Michael from the podcast Superhero Politics, a fabulous podcast. He will be joining us in reading The Incredible Hulk, Volume 2, Issues 24 through 25, a short reading, but very interesting, an arc called Always on My Mind, in which the Hulk deals with some of his feelings about his deceased wife. As always, we will link to those two issues on Comixology in the episode description in your podcast catcher. You can also find it on Amazon, probably, and possibly in your public library or local bookstore, if you look close enough. But that is it for this week. If you enjoyed our show, please like and subscribe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave a 5-star rating. We would appreciate it very much. If you want to keep up with us on social media, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SJWComicsCast or email us directly at SJWComicsPodcast@gmail.com. So, this was our podcast. We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.